Excited to welcome coordinator of integrated performance for the Los Angeles Dodgers, Clayton Thompson, to the Basketball Podcast. We're bringing on Clayton because the game is no longer just about hoops. It's about applied integrated science too. If you want to know how to make your players faster, more explosive, and better shooters, you have to look outside of basketball in other areas and other sports like baseball. Clayton Thompson serves as the coordinator of integrated performance for the Los Angeles Dodgers, where he sits at the cutting edge of professional sports science and player development. With a background as an R&D engineer and a master's in business administration, Thompson is a vocal advocate for dismantling the traditional silos between strength and conditioning and on-the-field success. Before joining the Dodgers, Thompson refined his data-driven approach at Driveline Baseball, the industry leader in data-informed performance training. His career also includes pivotal roles at TCU and Sanford Health, where he bridged the gap between collegiate athletics and clinical sports science.
Hey, Coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable, and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com. Contact page or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Clayton, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We connected online. I followed your stuff. I looked into it. I dove deeper. Man, I just had to have you on and talk about a whole bunch of things. But maybe first start, what is a coordinator of integrated performance?
That's a great question. Some days I don't quite know what it means. Basically, it's just coordinating throwing and lifting and warmups and all types of exercises and ensuring overall athletic development is how I put it. It's not living in the world of silos. It's not living in the world of strength coach. It's not living in the world of pitching coach. It's being someone who is worried about the holistic development of player development, or so the holistic player development. And I think that's really important.
Integration of sports sciences, that's something I've been sharing on this podcast for, I guess I've been doing it 8 years now. And my first exposure to it was around sports psychology. And this notion of having a sports psychologist that comes in, talks to your team, and then isn't embedded and isn't there. And I think similar paradigm now is shifting in terms of just what is a strength and conditioning coach. So maybe share with us there your thoughts on that.
I think to get at my belief on that, I have to talk a little bit about my background. I started programming athletes when I was 19 years old. I started my own training company, like training like 10 of my buddies. And then I was a strength conditioning guy for a long time, but I always wanted to be a pitching guy because I think strength and conditioning has an ability. You can get in the door a little bit easier than just like saying, I want to be director of pitching for whoever. And there's like a higher threshold. But I think that learning the theory of human movement, like here's how people respond, here's how people learn, sets you up really well to actually go into these skill coaching positions. And being a strength coach is cool, but I think the overarching point is that you should be a performance coach. You should be someone that works with players on and off the field, learning skill and in the weight room. It's not just a one stop. You're here with me to work on shooting. You're here to work with me on throwing. It's like, I need to understand why you move the way that you do and understand where the weak link, for lack of a better term, and it's not always going to occur on the field. You're going to see something in the warm-up. You're going to see something in the weight room that's going to connect a lot of the dots for you. Even though it's not always, for instance, someone has an inability to extend their T-spine in the weight room. It's not always like a one fix this and then everything else gets better. You're just creating a more clear and holistic view of the player while you work with them.
And imagine this is in baseball too, through the years. Coaches would get into these debates about different things. Like, for example, in basketball, how to close out. And I've always been the person that said, I'm not going to debate how to close out. I'm going to ask someone who's a professional in that, how to run fast and stop fast. My teaching on the closeout is the decision about where we want to influence the ball or what we're doing on that particular player. Are there parallels to that type of kind of old thinking, oh, a basketball coach should teach you exactly how to close out, when that should be an integrated model, shouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of people that still believe you have to do X, Y, and Z to throw hard. You have to do X, Y, and Z to hit the ball hard. And the industry is changing quickly, which is really cool. I think baseball is at the forefront of this technological change that we're seeing in sports. And for better and for worse, people are identifying biomechanical factors. But you have to have good bat speed to hit the ball hard. Like, pitching, throwing harder is good. We've come to the foundational battles have been won by the nerds. Like, it's, there are still people crying at home on Twitter, but pretty much every MLB team is like, yeah, throwing hard, we want our guys to do that. And I don't think it's happened in basketball yet necessarily. No offense to my basketball folks out there, but it's coming is the point. And you're already seeing it with the three-point shot. And the thing that I think will bite coaches is we have these biomechanical predictors. You have to hit them. You have to. And there's my immediate reservation whenever someone uses the word always, have to, must, is it's just you only have to find one guy. You only have to find one guy that doesn't do that. And then it's, you have the exception to the rule. And then you're like, here's our guy. So it's, you can't use blanket terms. And that is what's coming, because biomechanics is good. Having a real understanding of how guys are moving is good. Don't get me wrong. But going, everyone has to get to 90 degrees of elbow flexion. That was a huge thing in baseball for a while. Everyone needs to have good scap retraction. So all that means is just when you're throwing, your elbow has to come back a certain amount and create this stretch on your anterior side in order to create like a stretch of the elastic tissues on that side to transfer energy into the ball. So everyone has to get this much in this. Wait, no, they don't. So it's like, you're going to see it. I pretty much guarantee it, where it's like, everyone has to do this. And then Steph Curry doesn't do that. And it's all right, that then you should probably throw this away.
So there's very few musts is the way that we're thinking about it. But there are some commonalities to a pitcher, a batter, a basketball shooter, right? So thinking about commonalities, is that the right way to be able to think about this as biomechanical predictors?
Instead of commonalities, I would just use the word attractor states, or just stable attractors. Yeah,
let's go
stable attractors. Yeah, there are significantly stable attractors that you want people to realize in order to create efficient movement. There are absolutely things that you should do or get close to doing. It's like, yes, I assume one of these is in basketball where you should be releasing not on the opposite side of your head. That's like probably one of them. For in baseball, your arm needs to get up to around shoulder height, 10 degrees above, 10 degrees below is like 20 degrees above, 20 degrees below, all fine. You probably need to be in that range to have any semblance of a chance of throwing hard.
So that makes me reflect on my biomechanics going way back when, and there used to be a lot of musts, whereas, oh, the ideal shooter is 85% shoulder extension and all these different numbers that don't practically connect with me as much. Maybe more for me than some others, because I've gone into some of the science. But for coaches that are just listening and they aren't into the biomechanics and the different words that you're using, maybe let's start first with, what is a biomechanical predictor and what is a stable attractor?
Sure. Biomechanical predictor is you look at a movement report, and I also work at Driveline Baseball right now. So Driveline Baseball goes, your lead leg is bad because this ground reaction force is bad. This knee extension velocity is bad. So we have predicted through my buddy Adam Bluebaum, shout out to him. Hopefully he listens to this, but my buddy Adam Bluebaum just redid their whole report system. And he created some XG boost models where it's like the model predicts you're going to throw this hard and you're actually throwing this hard. And so we are looking at these features in our model where it's like, you need to get better at this in order for our model to predict that you will throw a different velocity. And so smart people like my friend Adam, who's significantly smarter than me, are creating very realistic predictions about people's throwing velocity. And I assume that this will happen with shooting accuracy in the future, based on these biomechanical factors where our model predicts you will make X amount of shots at this range. And if you overperform that, you have a higher skill. And if you underperform our prediction, you have a lower skill. And so that's a very overarching way of thinking about it. Model makes prediction. Are you better or worse? If you're better than what the model thinks you are, your skill at that thing is probably higher than other people in your population. So that's our thing. And on the movement side, a movement attractor is simply a stable coordination state. It is refined through thousands and thousands. We can talk about feed forward mechanisms. We can talk about feedback inducing these stable attractors, but all you need to think about is when I pick up a cup, my movement for picking up my cup is very robust. I can handle it, or dexterous, to borrow the Nikolai Bernstein term. Everyone should read that book, Dexterity and Its Development. Great book. You get to read about dinosaurs. It's so cool. That movement is very dexterous. You can do it a lot of different ways. So your coordination, your attractor state is very robust because it is able to adapt to many different situations, emerging movements. You can nest it with a lot of other movement attractors and other coordinative states. It's very dexterous.
So as an overarching theme for coaches, there's no perfect technique. Is that fair to say?
No, there's no, everyone is different.
Law of biological individuality, all the different stuff that comes from that. So then coaches are sitting there going, okay, where do I even start then? If there's no perfect technique, how can I actually understand how to help someone?
Yeah. It is hard sometimes. You guess wrong. You do the wrong thing. You get them worse. And that is a battle, but it's honestly so freeing. I view it now more as art, where a coach comes in and they don't really know what to do. And your interactions with the player dictate how that entire session go. You don't really know where to go. I talk about it a lot, like treasure hunting. I'm just out there on the sea. I have my treasure map. I have where I think we should go. I know what the movement attractors are. I know what stable coordination states look like. I know how to promote variability. I know how to use variability in order to change emergent movement or to change these attractors the way that I want to. And I have a feedback mechanism. So I have created a feedback loop. I can monitor the feedback and ensure that the athlete is learning. And we use that immediate and objective feedback right away every time. And sometimes you don't know what to do. And that is a really hard thing to struggle with. That's why in baseball, these biomechanic reports, for lack of a better term, these biomechanic reports are very helpful because it's a way better start. You're searching for something with the lights on instead of the lights completely off. So if I'm looking for my keys, I won't have the lights on.
Tremendous answer, by the way, because again, coaches maybe get tired of this, but I share the example of my oldest daughter, who's a science experiment for the world, basically, because I followed this process, very ecological with her shot. And I could share examples, and I will at some point, of the different phases of the development. And exactly that, asked her to do or had her try, or she did wrong things all the time. And she got worse sometimes. And I can picture those moments through a period of a phase of her development where she was doing things worse. But the result over time has been she's doing things really well and she's shooting really well. And that is such a hard thing for a coach who's used to giving someone, do this and you'll get better because it's worked before, and this survivorship bias, rather than, again, accounting for this individuality in her development. I love that you framed it that way. And I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that, but this process over the last 3-4 years has definitely been that for me. Is that similar to what you go through with a baseball pitcher? And then you talked about feedback loop, and I know I'm throwing a lot at you right now, but I love this conversation. How much of it is asking the athlete, how does this feel when you try it this way? Is that a part of it?
Yep. Great question. One of my favorite athletes right now has been up to 100 miles an hour. Great, phenomenal athlete. Learns very fast. Learned how to do like a kip up and some very complex gymnastic movements in 10 minutes. Throws 100. Worked with him for a month. 93 to 95 the whole time. Got him worse. Got him worse the whole month. And that happens all the time. And some days it's, I mean, you just don't know what's going on. It's, you're just searching for it. And then he texts you one day and it's, oh, I'm 96 to 98 today. I found it. Like I went back to what we were doing before. Or I think for the more elite athletes, asking them how it feels is significantly more important than novices, because novices don't know how it should feel. When I'm working with someone who's thrown 100, very elite athlete, been there before, does it feel like that time? I love the little red book of talent because it talks about, everyone should read that book, by the way. It talks about X marks the spot, or calling attention to good reps. Whenever someone has their best rep of the session, I always pause it. and I ask them to vocalize exactly what just happened. And then I ask them to go home at the end of the day and write down that rep and write down how it felt. And I think that doing simple stuff like that, where you're taking a little bit of time and you're taking, here's my book, by the way, and you're taking a little bit of time to figure that out and drawing attention to good reps versus bad reps and special attention to great reps, I think that is a winning formula every single time.
Love that formula. And I love that book, by the way, such a tremendous book as well. Kinetic chain, still relevant in terms of, that's one of those OG words that I learned a long time ago that helped inform me about shooting. And to some degree, how we're teaching shooting wrong. And I'm imagining pitching as well, because we're not focused on this summation of joint forces, essentially from largest to smallest muscles. And really for me, it's like, that's what connects back to feel when I ask my daughters or ask someone I'm working with for shooting is like, how does it feel? Do you feel effortless rather than effortful?
Yeah. That's where I think NOAA and a lot of other shot tracking technologies are going to come into basketball. It's no longer, you're going to go away from that a little bit more. I think that's good. Baseball has an inherent advantage because you just look at the number on the gun. And it's just like, how did that feel? Instead of knowing if it's better or worse, it's here's my shooting drills for the day. Here's my distribution of shot makes. Here is how many shots were at the optimal angle when they enter the rim or enter the hoop. Here's how many hit the rim versus not. If you have that breakdown, it's going to be inherently easier to have that conversation. And especially for elite guys where you're no longer working on makes, you're working on quality of makes. Same thing with pitch design in baseball. We care a lot about how a pitch moves. Some guys don't care about how hard they throw anymore. And having something that can track, can give immediate feedback, that's going to tell you a lot more than how did that feel. It can feel good. And a lot of guys do have really nasty pitches, but when they get in the game, they just get hit around. And you need to have an understanding of exactly how that pitch is moving and how it will look with the rest of their arsenal or what other pitches they throw. Probably going to be the same thing with different shot types where it's within a defender within 3 feet. What does your shot look like compared to when you're wide open? Some of these things are going to be big.
Which is a great point, which connects back to the concept I know that you share is this concept of adaptability, almost more than repeatability. Like ultimately, you're not throwing the exact same pitch the exact same way at any point, and you're not shooting the ball the exact same way at any point. You have to be adaptable relative to the environment and the different situation that it may be. Talk to us first about baseball then. Talk to us about the adaptability factor.
Time and time again, elite athletes have shown to be more adaptable early and less adaptable late. Same thing in shooting. Super, depending on the type of pass that comes in, very adaptable at the beginning. But every single time, Steph Curry, he doesn't release the ball the same. You can't do it the same. But compensation around release has to be ridiculously tight. It has to be pretty much he's within 1 to 2 degrees of whatever every single time. It might not be perfect, but it's going to be close. It's the classic view of the painter who's painting the perfectly straight lines, but their hands are shaking the whole time. He is able to compensate for earlier variability with precision later. And he's solving the degrees of freedom problem by creating complex joint coordinative units and synergies, which we can talk about if we want, but that might go over some people's heads. He's creating compensations for earlier movement in order to create this perfect position right at the end. So he's taking in a lot of internal variability and then creating stability at one really important place in time. Same thing with pitchers. Early variability, release point, energy going through the ball, super similar every single time.
So to understand that deeper, for a Steph Curry, the adaptability happens in his shot preparation prior to catching the ball, the variable footwork that he can apply to the situation, the variable angle at which he's going to catch the ball, and all the different loads that come from that. But once he's into his release, there's less variability.
Yeah. Exactly. I like to think about it, I guess now, as I'm writing more blogs and thinking harder about this stuff, is the energy he is putting into the ball and the direction of that energy is the same every time. So it's not necessarily his body's doing the same thing, but the resultant energy flow, which is how the body coordinates movement, is going to be so similar every time. It's crazy.
So the engine versus the steering. Can you talk about that relative to the athlete's ability to produce the force and then the obviously the player's ability to be able to apply the skill like you're talking about?
My friend Bryce Kreider, super smart guy as well. You should have him on for sure. Also works at Driveline Baseball, really into motor learning. He put me onto this concept of the software versus the hardware. And the hardware is what you're working on off the field. You're working on getting stronger, getting bigger, getting faster. And then you have built the engine to your car. You have it. You have the engine. You have the ability to access more force, more power, more strength. It's there. And then the software is the things that you're working on in the skill. It's you've created this output, this ability to go 160. And now it's making sure your skill is robust enough to handle that. And there's the skill is now the limiting factor, especially in baseball, where we know things like producing more force is good. Like we know that. I don't necessarily know if that's a thing in basketball, probably not, but jumping higher is good. Running faster is good. And if you can do those things, you're going to have the capacity for more efficient action, different actions, which I think is huge because you're opening up different states of coordination. If you're too weak to hit the optimal movement, for lack of a better term, to hit your minimum attractor state where your attractor is the most stable, if you're too weak and you cannot produce that energy, you're never going to produce it. So you're just opening up more possible movements by putting in the engine to your car. And therefore, when you work on the software, you're going to have more variability and more possible solutions to solve these emergent problems and creating organism environment solutions to those problems.
So I love this because baseball was one of those sports when I played it younger, it was boring to me because of the way we trained, right? The way we trained was not interesting. We didn't play baseball. We stood in a spot. We fielded the same thing over and over again. Obviously, there's variability from the environment, but generally, it was a very block training type of environment. I'm curious, has baseball and the environment itself and the way that we train changed a lot?
Actually, no, which is crazy, especially in youth levels, because a lot of this information is from youth coaches where I'm just going to train the kids the same way that I got trained when I was younger. I think you'll see it in different cultures and societies where these kids from not nice places with not nice fields are better at fielding, are better at throwing because of the more inherent natural variability. Balls take worse hops more often. Therefore, my fielding coordinated movement is more dexterous. I have practiced being dexterous significantly more than someone that plays on turf their whole life and never sees a bad hop. So it's quite different.
This does not surprise me because it's still the same in basketball, despite we've been sharing this. And I know others in this field have been sharing this in basketball for 10 plus years. And really, I would say by and large, the majority of youth practices have not changed at all. Some type of three-man weave, no defense, no decision type of drills to start, building up in progression, and then maybe at the end, finally playing basketball, some type of version of 5-on-5. But dominant is still these perfection drills. These drills where it's like we want to repeat the same solution the same way over and over again with no variability, no decisions. And that's still the paradigm that exists in basketball. And I'm curious, if you were to go coach a youth baseball team now, what would you do differently with that youth baseball team in that practice to account for some of these things we're talking about?
The first thing I always do when working with youth athletes is I turn it into a game. Whatever's going on is always going to be a game right away to get them more involved. However, there is something with youth athletes where they are growing so quickly and they are, every day is a new day for these kids. You can come to practice one day and you're like, man, I taught them so much yesterday, and you go right back to it and it just looks like they've never picked up a basketball, never thrown a baseball before. And it's a very non-linear process. And remembering that as a coach is really important. If I were to run a youth baseball team, I would make sure that we did the fundamentals really well that would carry them. I would make sure that there's some form of game, some form of variability creating. I think basketball does a great job at small-sided games. Baseball does not. I think baseball 5 is really cool for learning the rules. My kids, if they're under the age of 10, would probably just play that because it's super low impact, not less defender. It's just baseball with 5 people on the field instead of 9.
And more touches, more contact, more interaction.
Exactly. I'm also a huge fan of wiffle ball, where it's 3 guys on defense, 3 guys on offense, 1 pitcher, 2 fielders, quick switch. And There's thoughts on that, but getting throwing, getting hitting reps at that scale, getting that many touches is going to be really important when you're young. I remember when I was younger, just sitting in my buddy's backyard playing wiffle ball for hours, just me and him. Just he was pitching and I was hitting and then we'd switch. So it's doing stuff like that, I think, is really important. But there's also, same thing in basketball, really important things that you should know how to do. You should know how to get a cutoff from the outfielder. And you can only do that with, you know, five or six guys on the field at once in some form of block practice. And that does level up your knowledge of the game. And you do have to mix that in.
So I'm curious about two things.
Number one, you said fundamental. And in the ecological world, that tends to be sometimes a bad word for some people. So talk to us about what you mean by a fundamental, especially relative to baseball.
I just mean the skills that you use every time you're on the field. It's basically rotation. I think it's not like a singular thing that you have to do, but every time you're out there, you're doing some form of rotation. You should probably work on throwing. You should probably work on catching and work on fielding. Like those are the like fundamental parts of the game. And I guess that might not be an ecological approach, but you should be good at those four or five things if you're not going to play for professional sports. And I do believe in like donor sports, LTAD, stuff like that. And taking an ecological approach to getting good at these five things, but you should be good at those five things.
In basketball, shooting, passing, dribbling, all those fundamentals. Again, I'm with you on this, that you have to be good at those things. What I'm trying to help people understand is that the way players are learning nowadays is different than the way we did 25 years ago. And some of those things are accounted for separately from regular team practice. Is that the case in baseball as well, where there's the rise of the trainer off the court type of thing, where players are getting some reps on their own, or they're learning through video and consuming video? Like a basketball player can learn James Harden's move simply by watching it, staring at it, the stare to learn type of concept from Daniel Cole, and then going and trying it and applying it and figuring it out. And that's happening a lot in basketball.
Yeah, definitely happening more and more in baseball. Guys are going to private facilities in the offseason, and especially on the pro side where the offseason is actually longer. For a lot of guys, they don't really have a true offseason. Basically from when they're pretty elite in high school, they go to college and you get maybe a summer, but a lot of guys that are good go and play in the summer. And so where's your offseason? But when you do have time, these guys do tend to go to facilities, reach out to private trainers, and work on these things for sure. It has happened.
When you go to work with, let's say, a pitcher, when you go to work with a pitcher, you've never worked with them before, what do you do initially to be able to decide how I'm going to approach this, how I'm going to help them solve this problem? Whatever the problem
is. Hey, man, my name's Clayton. I do X, Y, and Z. I'm here to help you. What do you think you need to work on, man?
Love that. I love that so much. And it's start with the question and include them in the process right away. And that applies to all ages and all levels, right? That's a process that's just, I guess, at the cornerstone of coaching in the modern era, isn't it?
Yep. By the athlete in your program. The number one thing that you need to do as a coach is athlete retention. If your athlete doesn't do the program, nobody cares. It can be the best program ever. If your athlete hates it, you're a terrible coach.
I use the word active participation, that like you're an active participant in this process. This isn't me telling you, we're doing this together. And that's a part of it that helps for both a team and for a player. It obviously makes them feel more buy-in, but you know where it really helps, and I'm imagining you're feeling the same, is the parents involved. And whether you deal with the youth athletes, that's the key part of that, is the parents feel like they're involved in the process as well.
Absolutely. And it is a skill as well. I've seen coaches that are really good. Shout out Rob Hill, works for the Dodgers as well. When working with athletes, the athlete says something and you're just like, what are they even talking about? And then Rob Hill every time goes, you're absolutely correct. And then he says it in a way that the athlete still connects with them, what they said, but in a way where it's actually what they need to work on. And so he doesn't turn it on them. He immediately involves them. It's always, yes, you're absolutely correct. Here's what I'm thinking as well. So it's not, my mom always tells me never to use the word, but always use the word. And that's exactly what Rob does. It's incredible.
I love that. This is great. This is integration in the podcast as well, from the what and the why to the how we teach, all that's integrated as well, which I think is such a powerful part. And I can tell that you've spent time thinking about that. Hey coach, a brief time out from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. Do you know which players should be taking what kind of shots? An analytics system like Hoopsalytics can help your team make better shot selection decisions. You can track every kind of shot each player takes, where the shots come from, rate the shot quality, track if the shot was contested, and see the results. For example, see which players are taking mid-range floaters and measure the results versus catch-and-shoot jumpers. As an added bonus, Hoopsalytics shot charts are fully interactive, so you can filter by shot distance, shot type, or even specific areas of the floor. Then watch video clips of all those shots or see the points per shot. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your game for free. Let's think about shooting specifically a little bit and talk to you about ground reaction forces, the different things that come into shooting. And we have an obsession as coaches about footwork, but the whole point of the footwork is to be able to produce this ground reaction force, right?
The thing that's happened in baseball as well is realizing that the energy flows from proximal to distal and then flows back up distal to proximal. And coaches probably need to realize that viewing the spine and the pelvis as starting this ground reaction force is very important. The feet, I would dare say, just provide a stable base for the pelvis and the spine to do their thing in the shot. The feet are probably very variable and probably the most variable part of the shot besides where you catch the ball, if I was making any form of guess. And the pelvis and the spine actually produce these energies that flow down, and then the energy flows back up because of Newton's third law and back into these distal segments from the proximal. And so you might be producing ground energy force, but that's very misleading. You're creating muscle contractions on proximal segments that then flow into the ground, and then the energy flows back in from the ground into these distal segments, which flows back into the proximal segments and then flows into the ball.
So action reaction, classic.
And absolutely.
I know that's one of the most important things that influenced my daughter's shooting at a young age was just that ability to not break the chain, so to speak, to just be able to flow with their shot. And we almost obsessively focused on that over anything to do with the release and the technique of the release, because at first it just wanted them to be able to work within their body. Was that kind of a correct way to be able to approach a new learner or a novice learner in terms of just understanding shot and the goal of getting the ball to the basket?
Yeah, with novices, the most important thing is actually movement accuracy initially. So there is actually some merit to going, hey, here's how you shoot a ball. Like, your hand should probably be behind. You don't want them to self-organize into hands on the side. We know that hand behind, shooting with one hand through, that is going to be important, especially later. You do not want them to self-organize into something that is less optimal. However, you also want to promote variability within that pretty much as soon as they have that basic pattern down. You have the basic, the one thing you're pretty sure is super correct for when I'm working with kids, it's basically, is the arm inside 90 and is the elbow up? We have that one thing, we're dialed, let's go. Explore, refine. And once you exceed a certain amount of skill, then we really start caring about creating more, I guess you'd call optimal, but I want them to get dexterous. I want a coach to come work with one of my guys and go, hey, can you do this? And then my guy goes, yep, makes the change and it's smooth. It looks great, makes a change as quickly as possible, doesn't impact anything. And if it's the right change, they get better. I don't want a guy to go, hey, can you try to start with your hands up? And my athlete goes, I've actually never tried to start with my hands up in my life and it's going to ruin everything. That's the last thing I want.
I'm smiling because I've experienced this working with a number of players through my relationship with the NBA, a number of high-level youth players that literally when I try and get them to be adaptable or any type of differential learning or stuff like that, they absolutely almost break down because it's just not something they can do. And that is a limitation, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a question for you is, do you, with those guys, I think they would be premier candidates for shooting weighted basketballs. So is that something you've done before? Because if someone doesn't have variability and you just give them a weighted ball, it's going to, they can do the same thing, but it's already different.
what's a trend now is like a small ball, weighted ball. There's all these different balls. And I've certainly played around and I've certainly done some stuff. I'm curious the rationale behind this particular situation. Why a weighted ball for them?
I think because in baseball, we have a really wide variety of weights that goes, you can throw balls up to 4 pounds and you're immediately eliminating certain movements with the ball weight. It's just automatic elimination, adding constraints. This ball is this heavy, therefore this movement is no longer viable. It's the same thing about having the engine. And you can begin to target very specific things with ball weights. Someone, I was just working with a guy where he's typically more, I don't know if you experience this in basketball, but tight when he throws and he won't relax. And moving him to lighter balls that reward being relaxed because he's moving faster if he's relaxed, which I don't know if people understand that fact. I don't quite understand it myself, even though I've thought about it for so long. But if he relaxes, the ball velocity goes way up. So he's inherently rewarded and the feedback is a lot more clear. And if potentially a guy doesn't have a high enough high point or whatever, I don't even know the basketball term, but if he's not releasing the ball high enough and he's getting blocked too much, potentially going to a heavier ball where it's feeding the mistake and he's having to shoot it lower and lower and then going back to the normal, I don't know what the ball, NBA ball weight is, but going back to a normal ball, he's going to naturally self-organize into the movement that you want after repeated feedback. This doesn't work. This doesn't work. This doesn't work.
Wow. There's so much there, but yes, I've experienced that. And yes, that's very common for a player to not be relaxed shooting, especially when we give them an overabundance of technical information to be able to account for. Like a classic one when I was younger and still applies today is like coaches telling me, oh, your elbow's got to be in when you shoot. And as soon as I bring my elbow in, I feel tension in my shoulder, which again, doesn't help me be relaxed. And until someone, when I was again, pretty young as a player, thankfully I've met this coach, they told me to turn my feet from 11 to 12 o'clock. So my elbow is more square naturally. I became a better shooter. And yeah, it's amazing, right? It was like, it was not this technical information. It was just like, hey, try this, move your feet a little bit and see there's going to be a too far and there's going to be a too narrow. Like it was just beautiful to be able to see that. And now intentionally I do that with my daughters all the time to the point that I'll have my daughter shoot with super wide feet, super narrow feet, super staggered feet. And honestly, none of it matters at this point for them. They can adapt to any of those situations.
Yeah. That's also one of my favorite ways to be working with a player is altering initial conditions. We can talk about differential learning or we could talk about dynamic systems theory where altering the initial conditions impacts the resulting movement. And it's the like lowest, easiest tier of motor learning, but it works so well.
Can you give us an example? Maybe give us an example in baseball first so that we understand that, because I love where you're going with this. And I think this is something that is actionable for coaches.
Yep. Baseball, the best thrower on the team is not the pitcher. And that might be a wild thought for basketball guys. It's going to be the shortstop. The shortstop has the best arm probably on the team. There are obviously exceptions at the big league level once you get into professional baseball in college. However, I implore you to watch shortstops throw. It is incredibly beautiful. It looks like it doesn't look perfect because all of them throw different, but it just looks smoother. It looks better. It just looks more refined. It's like someone's just pushed them through a mesh over and over again. It is because of the variance of initial conditions when they receive that ball and the time constraint when they receive that ball. Pitchers don't have a time constraint. Pitchers can therefore self-organize into a lot of movements that technically are non-optimal for throwing as hard as they can and getting to the plate fast. Shortstops have to throw as hard as they can to get guys out and throw it across the infield at very far distances over and over again. Shortstops also have to field the ball. They are reacting to the ball's input. Their output is the result of variable input, making their movement systems more robust. Pitchers do not have a variable input. They have a static input, and therefore they are likely to fall into the same type of movement pattern over time, over and over again, where being a shortstop promotes more natural variability, more natural movements, and creates more dexterous types of throws.
So if I understand correctly, if I have a free throw shooter that I want to develop, then I don't want them to have to shoot, obviously, for many reasons. I don't want them to shoot 100 free throws in a row from the free throw spot. It would be much better to be able to have them shoot free throws from variable locations on the floor to be able to develop what you're talking about.
Exactly. I cracked up when I saw this on Twitter the other night, but Russ not doing his walk out to the half court and then come back to the line, and then his free throw percentage went way down. Obviously not robust. And doing stuff like varying distance, varying feet width, like we already talked about, varying just simply when they pat, like dribble the ball just where it stops, and then they go into their motion, that's going to be beautiful. Basketball, thankfully, already does a lot of this with passing. Like the ball comes in, and your pocket where you're catching the ball is different. So this, like bringing the ball up, is very refined already, which is really cool.
Yeah, with players I train, I intentionally throw really random passes all the time. Roll it, throw it high, throw it so it bounces, different things, so they have to adapt to that. So that makes sense to me too in terms of that. But that free throw seems to be the most static, easy example for people to understand that you gave us that analogy in baseball. And that connects. And this is actionable for coaches. Instead of having your players shoot 10 free throws in a row from their exact position, have them shoot it with the variable routine from variable locations on the floor, but it's still essentially a free throw.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just moving the mound back 3 feet, having the catcher move back 3 feet, moving the catcher up. Coaches do a lot of these things already when they're more old school, but they never think about it in terms of like it's good practice. A guy struggles with bouncing his curveball a lot, pitch that goes down, move the catcher back. He has to throw it up more. Like it's a no-brainer.
Love this. Can you give us, so differential learning, you've used the word. So explain it in simple terms. Give us maybe a baseball example, then we'll talk about in basketball.
Sure. Differential learning is basically just altering the initial conditions. That's literally all it is. There's a lot of more technical breakdown that you could go into, but really, if your understanding is I'm going to alter how this guy starts the movement, you've done a great job. So you could do crazy stuff like people like that to make fun of it online with doing cartwheels
into a shot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've done stuff like that before and potentially in baseball. So I'm about to sound crazy for a second. In baseball, we do a high-low model, just like every other sort of strength conditioning practice. Low model days, like why not? Like I'm searching for variability. I want to make sure my practice is fun, engaging. Obviously, I'm not going to make all my throws like a crazy man. I have a big league athlete that's been bored with their training for 10 years. Why not practice that one-footed jumper they're never going to shoot? I don't know. What if? What if one day he gets in the game, the ball's off to the side, he rolls, he falls, he picks up the ball and then slings it? There's doing cartwheels and jumping off stuff probably isn't great. But doing stuff like exploring movement states generally by altering initial conditions, ball weights, whatever, that's a pretty good idea.
So I love this analogy that you gave us of the shortstop, because I feel if coaches are thinking about this in basketball, there's more shortstops. Like in baseball, there's one shortstop, but in basketball, I feel if we can develop all of our players like shortstops in a way, they're going to be better players.
Yep. We want to develop shortstops as well. Yeah.
So that's part of your challenge then. Someone who's a first baseman in baseball is used to doing essentially one thing over and over again with some variability, but essentially they don't have as many robust opportunities to be variable in that position. Maybe I'm not understanding correctly, but that's my read on baseball. Whereas in basketball, literally we're moving to this positionless model where we want all of our players to essentially be these adaptable type of players. What are some ways beyond differential learning, which we gave you some examples. And by the way, coaches, I want you to note that Clayton said this earlier, is that doesn't mean the players are going to always shoot like that. Players are going to self-organize back to their regular shot, which I think is an important part that I want to say. But talk to us about different ways then to be able to develop these shortstops.
Yeah, I think it starts from youth, obviously. Shortstops get the most high quality touches. They're the best players from a really long time ago. When I was in Little League, I did not play shortstop because I was lefty. And I think that is messed up. On my Little League team, if there's a lefty, they're getting put out in shortstop. And it just feeds forward. So it's like, did you play shortstop before? No. Then you're not playing shortstop in the future. And you see it a lot in the NBA now with the guys that are 7'5 and can dribble. And when I was coming up in basketball, I was 6'4 and I was a center and I never learned how to dribble. But dude, I'm a shooting guard. Like, I should have been dribbling the whole time. It's like, I go to play pickup now and guys are like, you're a big man. Like, you're not that big. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Isn't this messed up? My youth coach absolutely screwed the pooch.
Hey, there's many youth coaches still screwing the pooch. And I can tell you the example that you're giving as a shortstop in youth basketball, because I've been around it for the last 3+ years, is the point guard. The person that handles the ball in youth basketball has an incredible advantage over everyone else. And I've always said to coaches, we need to rotate who handles the ball and who develops that, because that's just an incredible advantage for them to be able to constantly have these opportunities to be able to develop adaptability.
Yeah. In small-sided games, different guy starts the ball every time. In games, especially youth games, having a rotation of who brings the ball up. So just having an established order. It's you, then it's you, then it's you, then it's you, then it's you with the five guys on the court. Just having something like that. Canadian baseball, shout out to those guys for their LTAD model. They have like different caps on the kids, like different colored caps. It's pretty cool depending on the player's skill level. But something like that where this player, like knowing, having armbands on guys at practice, like knowing this player is bad at dribbling, so therefore they should get more of the dribbling touches, is important. So doing stuff like that in youth development, you have to be paying attention.
It's about the kids, right? It's about the kids, and we don't make it about the kids. And you asked me about the ball and modifying the ball, modifying the hoop, all these different things that we can do in basketball. And we literally have been around adults that literally would refuse to change anything because that's not real basketball. And I'm like, they're not real adults either. And that is a big challenge. So I love that example from baseball in Canada, and Canada's always, I'm Canadian, so I know that the LTAD model is a big superpower up there in Canada for sure. Talk to us about this process then, this long-term development process that takes place. And you referenced nonlinear. Talk about that relative to baseball, maybe relative to a professional player even, because I think we're always thinking players can't get better at a certain point, but they constantly can get it better, can't they?
Yeah, you talk to players and you go, hey, you know, you're 17, 18 years old. You're throwing really hard. That's cool. I don't care how hard you throw it right now. I care when you're in Dodger Blue, when you're in the big leagues, are you getting guys out and throwing 100? That is the pinnacle. When I talk to my kid in the future, I don't care how their youth basketball game goes. Are you going to make enough money in the NBA or in the MLB to make sure I can retire at 45? Is that the goal? So that's, you're developing the base for the pinnacle. And that's the foundation of motor learning is, are you dexterous? Can you perform in different situations? It doesn't matter if there's defender, no defender, three defenders, one defender, the count's 0-2, you're throwing to first base, you're throwing to third base, you're throwing underhand, overhand, sidearm, right-handed, left-handed, shooting with your offhand. I assume that's a big deal in the NBA. Shooting with your offhand, shooting with your onhand, like, all of these movement solutions exist and you can solve problems as they emerge. It is called emergent movement. You want to make sure that the interaction between the organism and the environment is as smooth as possible, no matter the combination of task, organism, or environment. You want them to be as adaptable as possible.
This is awesome for our audience to hear. And I know you had a chance to spend some time with Dave Love recently, NBA shooting coach Dave Love, and maybe share some of those takeaways and some of the parts of the conversation that I'm sure both way were beneficial that could help us as basketball coaches think.
Dave is the man. First of all, I just want to shout him out. He was talking to me a lot about this sandbox concept that I really love. I don't know if he's talked about this publicly, but he talked to me about it, where when he's working with a player, he's just trying to move them. If you imagine the sandbox is just like a 1x1, 1 inch by 1 inch box, a lot of guys are near the edge of the sandbox, where if you create any sort of variability, we've already talked about this, variability in the movement around them, they fall out of the sandbox and their movements are now degenerate movements that have no possible solution for what you're looking for. You want the guy to be in the middle of the sandbox, where if I have variability this way, move to the right or to the left, up, down, left, right, 360 degrees, you move me at all, still can solve the movement problem and have an emergent solution to these problems.
Emergent solution. Give us a quick definition of that for coaches that are listening.
Essentially, an organism is always trying to solve a problem based on the constraints that are on it right now. There's constraints on me as I'm sitting in this chair. I'm solving a problem of talking while I'm sitting. And that task combination, task environment where I am right now, And my internal monologue in my brain that's going on creates a very specific combination of constraints. They're not the same. Even second to second, movement to movement, discrete point to discrete point, it is always changing, and I am always solving this movement. Therefore, it is emergent. It is not a X plus Y. It's a X plus Y equals blank, because technically these processes are also nonlinear. So we can talk about non-fractal states and how my current movement is related to my prior movement. So I got this huge bug bite on my arm, and I haven't been able to set my forearm on the desk this whole time we've been talking. That movement that happened to me 2 days ago is still impacting current movement. In 2 days, when I am better, I will no longer be moving like this. I will no longer be sitting like this. The past impacts the future, what your predictions are. So humans focus on a feed. Humans think about action on a feed forward mechanism. Action is making those. So feed forward, I predict the future. The brain does this through allostasis as well. The brain, it creates biochemical action in the body, releasing hormones, whatever. And then at that same time, I'm getting prepared. My brain's preparing my body for action. My body has a prediction about my future movements. And then action is aligning my future with those predictions. And then any sort of deviation away from those predictions, we go back with feedback and we update the feed forward model. It's so incredibly fascinating what this emergent movement is. There's so many things that go into it. I'm sorry. I just love it so much.
I can tell your passion, but I love it. I love that you got your bug bite just so you give us that analogy as well. So thanks for doing that. But yeah. Like Clayton, what you just said, and I was going to ask you this, but it's a perfect segue. Like people, I know there's coaches. Like, why are we talking about CLA? Why are we talking about ecological? These players are good, or I got good because of this, blah, blah, blah. But it's our understanding of sports science in the way that you just explained that is one of the main drivers behind, we just know there's a better way nowadays. I'm curious how you explain that to people that maybe aren't there yet with their understanding of kind of your approach.
I would say to these people that don't understand my approach, I am working with the player. I don't want to take the player away from what has made them already good, because players that are very advanced, high enough level, have ideas about what they want to do. My approach is actually very adaptive. I can go into any situation, look at the tools I have, what the players want to do. I can turn it into a motor learning session. Doesn't matter what sport it is. I know that might be a hot take. I think I could go into basketball. I think I could go into soccer. I could go into anywhere where I have an understanding of what the rules are, what this player needs to get better at, and create a learning session. I fundamentally believe that I think you could do it too, just for the record. I think any coach that has a fundamental understanding of these principles, you could talk to someone about the domain knowledge. Obviously, you need to know what the movement attractors are, but I can go in and work with, I'm just going to throw a name that I know out there in basketball right now, is like LeBron James. Like, you could go in and work with LeBron James, and LeBron goes, I don't really want to do this today. I want to work on X, Y, and Z. And then you just go, great. Here's how I'm just going to structure these drills in order to work on these four or five things that you want to work on. And that's what I'm doing. I'm working with the players. I'm working with coaches that go, oh, we just need to do some form shooting today. It's all right. Cool. Cool. Let's do some form shooting. Like, I'm not here to say this approach doesn't work. This approach doesn't work. I am ultimately adaptable as well as the coach. It's not just the player.
Great. And we're going to do this too, is what you're going to say to LeBron, right?
Yeah. You want to do this? Hey, how about we try it this way the next time? Or can you try to do something a little bit different on this next rep? What if I just brought a defender in to defend you while you did these dribbling drills? You know, what if, you know, this looks a little bit too easy for you? Aren't you one of the best players of all time? What if we made it a little bit harder?
I'm not in my head to everything you're saying, because this is, I feel exactly what I do at this point in my career. Is I just got back from London for the Global Games, worked with the NBA Europe, and they put me in these gyms, 8 different gyms with variable number of players, sometimes 80 players in literally 2 hoops. And it's, coaches would always look at me, go, so what's the practice plan? I'm like, I literally have no practice plan, because how could I possibly be adaptable if I go in there? Now, I have an understanding of what I want to accomplish for sure around principles of play and some of these different things, but how we're going to do that, the environment is going to inform me. The players are going to inform me more than I'm going to inform them. So I love that example of working with LeBron in that type of way. And I think more coaches approach it that way. It's also less threatening for the athlete, isn't it?
Yeah, you're meeting them. They're not meeting you, which is a lot easier for them to come around on. This guy's working with me. Especially in basketball that I know is like more star-centered. I'm the guy. This guy doesn't know anything. And they're absolutely correct. I'm not making millions of dollars in the NBA. Why should they listen to me? Why should any baseball player listen to me? I don't throw 100. They throw 100. Not me. I've never thrown harder than 93. Why are they taking advice from me?
Well, because we know now that you know the science and the intersection of science and the integration of science in terms of these. And you've referenced a little bit working with the Dodgers, working with other baseball teams. This is now something that's very common, you're saying, in Major League Baseball, to be able to have someone like yourself involved in it from a data standpoint, from an understanding of the data and the understanding of the science and understanding of the skill, that part of it.
I think I'm one of one. I think it will happen more often. And there are definitely good, I'm not saying that there's not good coaches out there. Don't get me wrong. I think that the understanding of performance, of throwing, of motor learning is something that I've had to work very hard to achieve. There are people out there that are very good. In my unique situation, I think I'm one of one. However, I'm not slandering anybody. It's just this role, people are still pitching coaches. They're still pitching coordinators. They're still VP of pitching, whatever you want to name. You just go down the list, pitching performance. And I think that just the industry will change. That's all I'm saying. And I think that
less for better or for worse over time.
Exactly.
Is what you're saying. Yeah,
exactly. And I'm pretty sure I'm the only person in the world with my title. So I don't really know. No one is connected to me on LinkedIn with integrated performance coach. So at least I've got that going for me.
Which is why I wore my Dodger blue and why I had you on the podcast as well. But I'm sorry. I'm a Jays fan. I grew up in Toronto.
It's all good.
Yeah, but definitely it's amazing to hear both the intersection of your knowledge and your passion. And I think that's the driver. And when I say this to people all the time, I say these people, it's like analytics in basketball took over 15 years ago, whatever it is now. And now everyone can talk about effective field goal percentage and points per possession and all these different analytic numbers. And those become normal. At some point, what you're talking about, I feel, is going to become more normal. And you're one of the drivers of this, certainly in your profession and now hopefully in the world of coaching as well.
Yeah.
Same.
I hope it comes. I really want more coaches to be able to work with players in this manner. You're missing out. And sadly, for better or for worse, AI is coming. Writing player plans is no longer going to be a skill. And that's going to put a lot of people out of business, for better or for worse. So you still have to have a differentiator. What is going to be your differentiator as a coach when you just write exercise templates and just give them to guys? As a strength coach, as a pitching coach, it's going to be what is going to be your skill when you just write throwing programs and then you give them to guys. Why as a GM should I even hire pitching coaches anymore? And then obviously I don't believe that. Obviously I believe in paying my top coaches for sure, setting a culture of keeping my best performers around, keeping my pitching coaches that are significantly better than everyone else. I believe in that is my core tenet as a person and as a human. But that wave of thought is coming. Why do I need these people if I have AI to write all these programs?
And with my brand, Basketball Immersion, it's a great example. And I love the example you just gave. It's, yeah, like you don't need me nowadays to learn drills. You don't need me to do that. It's not about drills. It's about how to teach and how to blend all these different things together. And that's the blend of the art and science that we used to call it. And it's just gone deeper nowadays. And it's beautiful to be able to hear you talk about it and to hear you change it. And I know a lot of coaches, a lot of the words that you shared are going to be a little bit new or a little bit like not fully there yet for them. But coaches, I can't encourage you enough to dive deeper. You just referenced AI. Man, it's not hard to type in degrees of freedom and find out degrees of freedom. How does that apply to basketball coaching? And you're going to learn some of the basics that kind of can help inform you from there. Any other advice to coaches in general as they move forward after listening to this?
Listen, if you have any questions, just hit me up. Like literally I've got nothing going on. I love to help people learn. I love learning to learn. And like, that's the least I can do for someone that's listening to this podcast. I can't believe people listen to me online. I still feel like I'm 19 years old reading books in my room. And I do think coaches, you have to learn the fundamentals. That is the most important thing you can do. And I'm not just talking coaching fundamentals. What is energy flow? That is a question I have been fundamentally trying to answer for the last 2 weeks while writing this blog and calling it the thermodynamics of pitching. It's crazy. And it goes super deep into these basic motor learning principles from researchers from the 1970s. That's what I'm talking about. Understanding Gibson, how information flows, how optical information flows, what the perception actually and coupling actually is, reading fundamental papers, understanding truly what's going on. So then I'm basically stealing this all from another book called The Art of Doing Science and Engineering by Richard Hamming. So you can understand future advancements in your field. Because what we know now is just going to exponentially increase over the next 10 years as we're working in this industry. And people that know how to learn, people that know how to upgrade their coaching game from going from, that's why Dave Love is going to make it. He knows how to upgrade his fundamental thought process. And he will be one of the coaches that keeps going as this information evolves. And if you're a coach that learns how to learn and knows the foundational bedrock of your coaching philosophies, and you have your tenets and you hold them near and dear to your heart. Like, I believe in Gibson's theory of direct perception. That is going to be huge when people keep putting out papers like my boy Turvey on, I don't even know, non-fractal movement. I don't even know what a dissipative structure is. I'm learning all the time. And oh my God, like it, every fifth word in this paper is a nonsense word. So it's, you just have to keep going. You have to keep learning the fundamentals.
Tremendous advice, and cannot thank you enough. At Clayton_T22 on Twitter and at Thompson_throwing on Instagram, and then at DrivelineBB on, I think, both platforms as well, right? Great places to be able to reach out. And coaches, I just DM'd Clayton and we started a conversation from there. And I'm telling you, I'm a better coach because of it. Thank you so much for sharing the game. And this won't be the last time that we have you on.
No, I hope not. I want to come back and play basketball. Also, just sidebar, I love playing pickup hoops. So if anyone out there is, damn, I wonder if Clayton can come and play pickup hoops. Look, I travel a lot, so I would love to come to a
He's
cool
always
gym
ready
and play
for a
pickup
game.
Hoops. Yeah, so I actually love basketball maybe more than I love baseball. That's like,
just don't put you in the post. Don't put you in the post.
Nah, I just rebound, man. I can't shoot. So I got to get my deliberate practice in.
There you go. Love it. Thanks, coach.